You're listening to the USEA official podcast, which takes you behind the scenes of eventing, covering all the big events, professional tips and tricks, interviews, special guests, and the latest USEA eventing news. Welcome to the USEA official podcast. Listeners, welcome back. We hope that you are all keeping well. And we have got another new episode for you. Now, today's guest is a man who I hope is going to give us all a little insight into ourselves. Paul Hafner, who is a sports psychologist with a real focus on the equestrian industry. And I feel like that is such a broad sort of explanation, Paul, of your experiences, because you have got so much knowledge that you bring to the table from lots of different walks of life. So before we dive on in and sort of look at how we can channel sports psychology in the equestrian industry to better our performances and better our lives, just give us a bit of an insight into to your background and your experiences.
Sure. I am by training a clinical psychologist, and I saw my first client back in 1987, so I've been doing this a really long time. Prior to that, I was trained as a teacher, and I've also done some teaching over the last 20-some-odd years as well. And since the late 90s, I've been working to connect my passion, which is horses. I've been a lifelong horse nut, with my professional training. So since the late 90s, I've been doing work with riders, serving the equestrian community as a sports psychologist, and then also doing what we call equine facilitator or equine assisted psychotherapy.
I feel like any kind of therapy involving horses is surely, I'm sure plenty of listeners listening to this, when they go down to the barn every day, it is their own little slice just in their daily lives. Just give me an insight into what are the biggest challenges that you come across, the most common challenges that you come across and people come to you for help with in the equestrian world. And we might pick apart a few of those.
Okay. When I started out doing the sports psychology work, I thought that I would be dealing mostly with performance enhancement oriented stuff. And certainly I deal with a lot of that. However, the vast majority of people who seek me out, either because it's a significant challenge and issue with equestrians, or because they see me as someone who can help them, is around issues of intense anxiety. Sometimes it is anxiety that pops up out of nowhere. Sometimes it's people who have an anxious temperament and are really trying to deal with that as it affects their riding. But a lot of people are coming because they've had, one of those inevitable spills, and at some point along the way, they're an injury or being overfaced or having had an accident has really gotten in the way of them doing what they want to do. So that's where I think I spend most of my time now.
Would you think it's fair to say, because it feels like sports psychology is something that over the last few years in the equestrian world, a lot of more people have started to talk about it. And it's therefore become something that more people, speak about to their friends, and therefore getting help rather than suffering in silence and sort of trying to battle through on your own is becoming more widely accepted, encouraged, and that kind of swell of you're not alone. You don't have to battle nerves and anxiety on your own. Other people are in the same situation, and you can get help and you can find things to help you cope.
Absolutely. It's actually one of the most exciting things for me, watching how things have developed over the last 20 plus years. When I started out, I actually was looking all over for somebody who could mentor me, because I wanted to have somebody with experience in the field. And I ended up working with Janet Edgett, who's a psychologist who is in Pennsylvania now. And it was really, really hard to find people who were doing this work. There were really only a couple of people who are doing this work then. And now it's actually relatively easy to find people and find help and find resources. Europe, Australia, far ahead of the United States. I think part of what we've struggled with here is we have sort of what I might think of as the cowboy up mentality, that somehow there's some toughness you're supposed to have and you're supposed to be able to do it on your own. But we're breaking through that now, and more we see people feeling freer to help, seek out help and seek out assistance. The only thing that I would like to say, because it doesn't really get talked about a lot in terms of the help that's available, is to let people know that people working within the sports psychology industry have different types of training and may be more or less suited for the challenges that you in particular are facing. So there are, for example, one of the things that I bring to the table, that Janet Edgett brings to the table, that Jenny Susser brings to the table, these are people who have doctorate degrees in mental health. So they've been trained in a particular way. There are other people who are fabulous, right? Tanya Johnston is one that comes to mind, April Clay in Canada, they've been around a long time. They don't have the clinical background, but they are you know, extremely talented and well educated in dealing with the performance issues. So it's helpful to know that different people are going to bring to the table different talents when you're looking for help.
I guess the first thing is to think, if you know, kind of pin down what it is that you are struggling with. Is it nerves before a competition? Is it sort of general anxiety around maybe you've had a loss of confidence or something, and kind of pin down what it is that you need help with, and then look specifically for those areas. If we were to look at it very generally, because I appreciate that the levels of nerves and the levels of sort of how people sort of face challenges in their sort of equestrian lives are very different. So I'm looking at it sort of quite generally in this respect. But if our listeners tuned into this show sort of go to a horse show and all of a sudden paralyzed by fear, because as we always say, it's meant to be fun, isn't it? You know, we do the horses for fun. So we want to be able to channel that as much as we can. But, you know, maybe they get particularly nervous going down the front line in the dressage. Maybe, you know, the cross country is the part that really finds them out slightly. What can we do? What should we be looking for in our daily lives and as we go about sort of our competition schedule to be able to kind of make a few very simple adjustments that might help us start to challenge our nerves into a more positive outlook?
Right. So one of the things I've begun to talk about is about breaking it down in a way that I think is helpful. Rather than think about it as all of these different interventions and picking and choosing, it's helpful to think about what you're trying to do and that there are different purposes for intervention. So let me explain what I mean. So one thing that we could think about is we all have a certain amount of stress tolerance, and we talk about it as a worry bucket or a stress bucket. And when that, you know, we experience stress or anxieties or things, we fill up that bucket, and when it overflows, then we have reactions where we shut down or we get frenetic or, you know, those are the things that really block our participation. So one of the ways we can think about helping ourselves is engaging in activities or behaviors that are going to empty our bucket before we get to a competition. And what that does for us is that having that empty bucket, then when the little things go wrong, which they inevitably do, right? You forget this piece of equipment, or something, the schedule changes, or you have a hard time loading your horse, or there's all these other little things that happen, then we are better able to take that in stride, that we have greater resilience moving into that. So a couple of simple things that we do to empty our bucket. For some people, it's about using things like relaxation techniques in the days leading up to a competition. So taking time to teach yourself. There's a well-known procedure called progressive muscle relaxation, a great thing to teach yourself to deeply relax, okay? This is where the relaxation that comes from, if you have a playlist or music that calms you or relax you, taking time to just take a deep breath and letting go. There are other things, and we also put them in the bucket of recovery between competitions, is to think about things like making sure you have appropriate rest and that you have social connection with people that bring that sense of joy and ease to you. All of these things, exercise regularly, eat well. These are all the things that we can do to help empty our bucket and make sure we're resilient going into a competition. So that's one thing that we can do. There's another thing that we can do, which is about sort of like our mental and emotional workouts, right? Everybody knows that to ride, especially eventers, more than perhaps any other discipline, know that, for example, their physical fitness is really, really, really important, because not only are they asking their horses to do amazing things physically, they're asking themselves to do that. So a lot of serious eventers take their physical fitness really seriously. And we can take our mental and emotional fitness really, really seriously as well. We can strengthen those capacities, which are going to help us, again, kind of ride the wave and work through things if we run into bumps in the road. The simplest method for doing that, because it incorporates a bunch of things, which I share all the time, is the idea of mindfulness meditation. And it does a couple of real things really well. There's a number of apps out there. That one that I've used and recommend all the time is Headspace. And then there's another app, I think it's called MindSight Timer or Mind Timer? I can't remember. Not used that one, but I've heard it recommended often. But the idea of mindfulness meditation is you're practicing a couple of things. You're practicing focusing your attention. You're practicing and growing awareness of what's going on inside of you. You're working and preparing and developing your ability to accept and then let go of things. And this is without that critical voice, because that's where a lot of people get stuck. And then you're practicing again, refocusing yourself. So that's a cycle that we go through repeatedly, and that if we develop a mindfulness meditation practice on a regular basis, we're doing that kind of day in and day out kind of workout. And it's going to strengthen those abilities to bring them to the table when we get there. So we've got the emptying your bucket. We've got the working out, the skills that you're going to need for the moment. And then we get to the competition, right? And we need a couple of things to help us. One of the things that is really, really, really helpful for us are techniques that we can use to regulate our arousal. So if we start, of course, being aware when our activation, our emotions start to rise, there are a number of techniques. We don't have to go into all of them with great detail, but there's a couple of simple breathing techniques which are really helpful. And these are things that are really helpful in managing our arousal. One of the most common ones is called box breathing, where you breathe in for four, hold for four, out for four, hold for four. And what that does is again, I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but that our breathing is connected to how our neurophysiology works in a way that keeps the parts of our nervous system which regulate our arousal online and working. Okay, so that's a really powerful, simple technique which can be practiced so you're comfortable with it and that can be used in the moment of competition. And then, you know, there are other things which, so you have techniques that we can bring to the table while we're competing. And then at the end of it, we also have things where I talk about it as being transformational change, which, and that's more of the kind of bigger picture stuff that you work on maybe in between competitions, and where it, you know, we are affected by what things mean to us. So we can look at how we react to competition in specific situations, better understand what meaning we're making of it, transform our understandings of it. These are things that really help us change how we react and respond to larger situations. So for example, you know, this is where we think about, you know, people who become really self-conscious and think, oh my God, you know, everybody's looking at me. They have thought patterns like, you know, if I mess up, I'm going to let my family down. I'm going to let my barn mates down. I'm going to let my trainer down. You know, these are kind of meanings that we can shift and change big picture, which are really helpful for people. And there's a whole bunch of techniques, things that I use with people. You know, I work with neuro-linguistic programming, which is NLP, which are a whole host of techniques to help make those kinds of changes. I'm a clinical hypnotherapist, so I can use those sorts of techniques. And much of this also can be worked through conversationally. So that's a whole range of things. And again, I think it's helpful to break it down into, you know, these ideas. You know, what can I do to empty my bucket? What can I do to sort of work out mentally and emotionally to come to the table with the skills I need? What can I do to regulate my emotion in the moment? And what can I do big picture to change, you know, how I carry things, how I think about things, and the meanings that I make of stuff?
The bit that stands out for me, because honestly, it's so interesting. I'm sure plenty of people, I was sat there nodding along thinking, yes, I've thought that before. And yes, that makes sense. But everybody, you know, you go to the gym, don't you? And you physically get yourself fitter. And it therefore makes total sense that actually, if you make your mind and your emotions fitter, they're going to be stronger and more capable of dealing with things. But actually, you know, that for me is a concept that I hadn't really considered before, and perhaps is something that people, you know, give less time and thought to. But actually, it makes total sense that if you train it, you'll get better.
Absolutely. And the great challenge with that, as you may know or have noodled through, is that, you know, if I go to the gym and I start working out, right, I can measure my, you know, VO2 max, and I can, you know, run on the treadmill for a month, and I can measure my VO2 max, and I can see that I'm more efficiently processing oxygen. Okay. I have very clear benchmarks. You know, I'm lifting heavier weights. My heart rate doesn't increase as much. I mean, you have very simple and direct feedback for our fitness. With mental and emotional fitness, it's much more subtle. We don't have the same kind of benchmarks. And the challenge that that we face, or that, let me just rephrase that. The challenge that I have with many of my clients is to help them to be consistent in the practice of things and patient long enough, A, so that these practices become habit, and B, so that they can benefit from them. Because if you go home and you do mindfulness meditation for a week, you might feel relaxed and stuff like that. But the bigger benefits for you are more likely to be felt after you have practiced for 3 to 6 months on a consistent basis. So it's a real challenge kind of convincing people that this is a great investment. So, and my experience clinically with this is that if I can get somebody to buy in and to do something like regular mindfulness meditation, that after 3 to 6 months, they begin noticing changes in how they react and respond. But more importantly, what they report is, hey, I got people coming up to me and say, what are you doing? You just seem so different, right? Because they're they're behaviorally less reactive to situations, and other people start noticing those changes. So yes, it makes great sense, but it's also something that ends up being really subtle. And because of that, in our day and age, when we want to see results and measure things right away, it's more of a challenge getting people to buy in.
So there you go, listeners. You've got to commit to it and you will see the effects long term. I want to sort of link it now into the horses and the horsemanship side, because, mm-hmm. you know, it's all very well dealing with ourselves, but we're mm-hmm. also dealing with another living, breathing animal. And therefore, we're sort of trying to understand them as well. And I know, you know, that phrase horsemanship, we use it frequently and it can be bandied around a little bit. But how is the link? How much more difficult is it? How much more self-aware do we need to be? Talk to me a little bit about that, because I think that is a really fascinating part of equestrian sports that are different to other sports where, you know, you're just competing for yourself against other competitors.
I don't want to give you a canned answer, but I want to give you a relatively concise answer. So let me see what I can pull together here. So one of the challenges in answering your question is that different people want different things out of their relationship with their horses. And I want to respect that different people approach the sport in different ways. There are some people that, you know, approach it more like just an activity that I do, and there's less focus on their relationship with specific horses. There are other people that focus on it as an art form. There are people that have goals and ideals that run the gamut. So all that being said, one of the things is, from my perspective, is that self-awareness and self-regulation, I'm going to use a different word. I'm going to take a little side trip here. There's a psychiatrist, his name is Dan Siegel, and he wrote a book called Mind, The Journey to the Heart of Being Human. And one of the things that he said is that we don't talk about what it means to be well. So he defines wellness. And what he says is that to be well is to be well integrated. And when he talks about integration, he talks about having access in the free flow of energy and information between all the systems that make us human. So that involves awareness of what's going on with ourselves physically, what we're thinking, our emotions, our senses, integrating all of that information and integrating the information that's coming and connecting from our relationships with others. Okay. And what I would say is that to be well, to be a well-integrated person is the best space to engage with and develop a relationship with another, whether it's a human or, in this case, with our horses. So as a personal agenda, I'm always going to want to grow and develop in my ability to be well integrated, which means that I have to grow in my awareness of myself physically, right? You hear about people that are all up in their heads, and then you're trying to work to help them connect to their bodies. You have people that are just in their bodies, and their head is nowhere, you're helping them connect to their heads. You get people that are self-focused and they lose their awareness of what's going on in the world around them, right? So you're connecting them in their awareness to the world around them. So from that perspective, anything that we do that increases our awareness and helps us to be better integrated is going to help us in our horsemanship. And when you think about horses, it's exactly what we do with them, right? We're trying to help our horses to be well-integrated beings, right? And you could think of this in a number of different ways. So you know, very simply, you know, a horse in terms of balancing their woe and their go, right? You want to balance that their activation and ability to bring their energy up and their ability to bring their energy down. That's a simple example of it. You want horses to be aware of the surroundings. We spend a lot of time, right, helping horses learn about where their body and their feet are in space. Jumping gymnastics exercises, right? How to carry themselves. We work in dressage to help them carry themselves in particular ways that help them then balance themselves in the movements that really, really interested in, you know, to do a particular test at a particular level. We also want them to focus. We want to be able to direct their focus. That's, for example, to focus on a jump they want to do, but we also don't want them to lose a sense of where their body is in space and everything that's going on around them, right? And we want to keep that open line of communication with them, right? All of that is helping our horses to sort of balance and integrate their awareness. And we're going to be in a better place to do that by being aware and integrated in ourselves. So that's a pretty long answer to your question. Did that touch on what you were thinking, or is there something else that you were wondering about?
No, I think it's fascinating because all of those things that you sort of touched upon over the last sort of 30 minutes or so as a human, actually, when you start to translate some of those areas to horses as well, because I mean, you could look at it in the sort of the same way as, you know, we can train ourselves emotionally, we can train our minds. And actually, to a degree, as a rider and as a trainer, we do that with our horses as well. You know, we help them in situations that they find stressful. Right. And so actually, like, understanding it ourselves is only going to help us understand it to them. But actually, we can translate it quite literally to the horses.
Absolutely.
And I just find that really interesting. And I know we're sort of only scratching the surface here because it is, you know, there is so much we could go into. One of the other areas that I wanted to ask you about, because it was something, listeners, that I found really interesting, and we've kind of talked about training ourselves in this respect, and that is the neurofeedback brain training. I'm fascinated by the idea of training our brains because we're so much more complex than I think most of us realize. So just tell me what that is and how we sort of how it is done and what benefits it can have and how that can transpire into actual real life.
Absolutely. So as with everything, this is a pretty broad domain. And there's a couple things for people to know. And the first thing to know is that not all brain training is the same. So there are different varieties of brain training, and I'm going to make a distinction between two specific varieties. One is, we call it linear, and the other, you can call it dynamic or dynamical. And so linear brain training is when we decide what brain states are going to be beneficial for us, okay? And then we have systems that are designed instead set up either to attract our brains or drive our brains into a particular state of mind. Okay. Those types of training can be really, really helpful. They can provide that kind of reset that we talked about, you know, helping us to find those restful states, quiet our busy minds, make it easier for us to access those states of being. So that's one way, you know, one approach to brain training. And there's a whole host of different approaches to that, different ways of doing that have been developed. The other is what is called dynamic or dynamical brain training. That's the stuff that I made a choice to invest in for myself and for my clients. And it's a bit of a different beast. What it does is provides feedback to your brain when it's going to shift. And then because it provides that feedback to your brain then gets to decide, do I continue shifting because that's what I need and want to do? Or am I going off the road and I need to get myself back on the road? So without going into a lot of the technical detail of it, what happens is in our brains is that, let's say you think of it, let's use a symphony metaphor. So we have a symphony that's happening in our brain, and we're playing, let's say, Beethoven's Ode to Joy. And that's what's playing in our brain while we're doing a particular activity. And then it's going to go shift and play Mozart. Well, when our brain makes that shift, it gives off a very characteristic electrical signal, which we can pick up on. And there is a simple way to orient our brain to the fact that it's going to change. And we do that by using something that happens for all of us. It's called an orientation response. In this case, we're listening to music and we actually hear a skip in the music. And our brain goes, what was that? And it said, oh, I'm going to shift. And when it notices that shift, then it says, yeah, I do need to play Mozart now. Or it can say, you know, we got to finish Ode to Joy, right? It's this, and in that process, the cool thing about the dynamical brain training is that what it's doing is helping your brain naturally regulate itself. And you don't have to do anything. You don't have to decide what it's going to do. You don't have to push it to a particular place. You let your system operate as efficiently as your system can operate, right? And that's one of the beauties is that I think it's sort of a philosophical thing for me is that I want everybody to benefit from and utilize, you know, their particular pattern of strengths. And the dynamical brain training helps people's nervous system and their brains to function in their own individual way in a way that's efficient for them.
I honestly, it's so interesting and fascinating. I feel like we could dive down so many different sort of rabbit holes, but I'm aware that we spent far too long on each of those individually. Paul, just very quickly before we finish this, you know, in terms of people listening to this and they sort of want, I'm not going to call them quick wins because it's not mm-hmm. that, but some mm-hmm. easy things that actually will make a real impact and a real difference in their life. What would be the biggest things that you could say that actually people could and should go away and do to really give themselves every chance of channeling nerves or feeling better and kind of being as well within themselves as they can mm-hmm. be?
I keep coming back to the idea of a mindfulness meditation practice. And I'm open. It doesn't have to necessarily just be a mindfulness meditation practice. It could be a yogic practice with, I'm going to butcher it, but there are breathing practices in yoga, pranayama, I want to say something like that. Some sort of practice which allows them to focus and to allows them to slow down and allows them to build those capacities for self-awareness, self-acceptance, and focus. Those are the things that I think the three things that I would say. And that ultimately, big picture, is going to have the biggest impact. The other thing, which is just a bit of perspective, which is really, really, really helpful to people. There's a lot of good information out there with all of these techniques that we've talked about and strategies. There's a lot of books out there that can talk about these specifics. And the piece of wisdom that I would want to add to that for everybody is if you find a tool you want to use, you have to practice it when you don't need it so that you're comfortable with it and you're solid with it before you walk into it. So if you wanted to learn about using, for example, visualization or imagery as an effective tool, you don't learn about imagery and then wait till you're in the heat of the moment and then say, okay, now I'm going to use this. It's something that you practice day in and day out, that you get it working for you, that you're using it to pattern, to create new patterns for you. Even with the breathing techniques, right? If you learn a simple breathing technique, you know, box breathing, you don't, well, I learned about box breathing. So now I'm just going to wait until, you know, I'm in the starter box and my horse is really, really hot. And I'm really nervous because I'm stepping up a level and okay, I'll do box breathing. Well, no, not unless you've practiced box breathing going all along. So that idea of building your comfort with tools before you have to use the tools will make all of these tools that are available to you through your reading and podcasts and videos and stuff, that's going to help make all of that more effective.
Train yourselves, listeners, as though you're training your horses. You wouldn't go into a dressage competition and start doing lateral work for the very first time in your horse's career. You would have trained it at home and then you'd be comfortable with it. I love it. Paul, thank you so much. It has been so interesting to get your take on it because there's so many different facets to the human brain and our bodies, our minds are just such a source of interest. And I think we could, as I say, keep talking about various different bits of it. So this has just scratched the surface. Listeners, I would say if you want to go and find out more about how Paul does things and sort of more about the neurofeedback brain training or any of the other things that we've talked about, go to his website, ridingfire.com, and you'll be able to have a look and get in touch with any questions that you might have. Paul, thank you. It has been a pleasure to have you on the show, and we really appreciate it.
It's been an absolute pleasure for me, and I'm so excited that you are, you know, making the effort to put this information out there because I think it's, as you said earlier on, I think it is something that people are becoming more aware of, and there's so much help out there for people.
And it's okay. It's okay to talk about it. It's okay to try and be better. I am off to go and download the Headspace app and go and do some mindfulness training because you've converted me. I think that's definitely something I can use in my life. Paul, thank you. Listeners, thank you. As always, we have got lots coming up for you on the USEA official podcast. So do stay tuned. But for now, from us today, thank you very much for listening. Thanks for listening to the USEA official podcast. If you have any suggestions or feedback, then we would love to hear from you. Get in touch through any of our social media platforms at US Eventing, and don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform to make sure you don't miss an episode.